Okay, it's 9:01, so I'm going to, on my computer, I'm going to start. Mel, I don't know if you heard, I said that they neglected to send out the email reminder, in which case some people probably don't realize, and other people don't, unfortunately, don't realize, as I know from experience, that it's the same, you sign in the same way each week. If they don't get the email reminder, they're not sure how to sign in. But in any event, as I've already mentioned on numerous occasions, many more people listen on tape. So if we only have probably get a few more, it doesn't matter. I will do the class. And I want to begin with two things before we start. And this is the last class of the semester. Actually, I will hold off on one of the things I wanted to talk about because the person who asked is not here. So let's just get right into it. And I was asked by someone who doesn't listen live, so I'll do this as well. You wanted me to repeat what I was saying at the very end about, maybe I wasn't clear, about Rabbi Hanan Wasserman learning with the Rabbi Chaim of Brisk. What I said was that in this book, which is the translation of Rabbi Hanan of the Hebrew volume, it says that in the summer of 1897, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman meets Rabbi Chaim of Brisk at this resort area called Libau, and he spends a few weeks with him, and he was so impressed by him that he immediately, after the summer, goes to Rabbi Chaim and spends 2 years in Rabbi Chaim's home, quote, receiving personal instruction from Rabbi Chaim, from whom henceforth he regarded as his true mentor. The problem with this is that this could not have happened in the summer of 1897, and I don't believe it ever happened, for the simple reason that, as I mentioned, in Volume 2 of the collected articles and letters of Rabbi Hanan, he's writing in Kislev he's writing in the winter of 1898. This is page 92. And he's writing to Rabbi Yitzchak Kosofsky, that's the brother-in-law of Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzinski, and he says, I'm going to send you now, remember, this is the winter of 1898, I'm sending you some of the writings of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, which I copied from his writings last summer. And then he says, last summer, that's the summer of 1898, I was together with Rav Chaim for the second time, and I received much from this, much more than the previous year. I received much more, that is, in learning. And even though I was only with him for 6 weeks this time, nevertheless, I knew how to value this time, and I gained from it, and I spoke to his son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and I learned much of his writings, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, so he's saying that last summer, I spent 6 weeks with Rav Chaim, the summer of 1898, and I was able to benefit even more than the previous summer, i.e., he was not studying with him for 2 years straight from the summer of 1897. In fact, as I just mentioned, the winter of 1898, he's not with him at all. He's saying that I spent 6 weeks with him in the summer. But that's months ago. So I don't believe it's at all true that he ever spent any serious time with him in Brisk before he goes to Brisk, as we will talk about very soon. But that comes a good 13 years later than what's described in this book. Now, I grant you that this book was written, that is the biography, before they had the Kovetz Ma'amarim, before they had all of these letters, so that it could explain the mistake. And this presumably was some sort of story that went around the yeshiva world. We left off last class by me saying that in 1898, Rabbi Hanan Wasserman marries the daughter of Rav Meir Atlas. Rav Meir Atlas, who in his day was a well-known Rav, completely forgotten today. Yeah, he didn't write Sfarim, so that's one of the reasons why he's forgotten. But he was, you have plenty of rabbis who wrote Sfarim who are forgotten. He was a well-known Rav in his day with, he had sons-in-law who were Rabbanim, another repeat member of his family. I mentioned also, and this I think was the last thing I said, that in Making of a Gadol, it mistakenly states that Samuel Atlas of the Reform Hebrew Union College, whose letters back and forth of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg I made so much of in the seventh chapter of my book, he says that this is the son of Rameyer Atlas. It's not. I'm assuming it's part of the family. The name Atlas is not the most common name, but it is not the case. Rameyer Atlas, though, was a great Rav, and the fact that Rabbi Hanan Wasserman was chosen to marry his daughter, I'm talking about an era where people did not decide on their own who to marry, these were marriages were arranged, that doesn't mean that you had to accept it, but it was arranged for you, the daughter and the chassan, they were arranged. The fact that Rabbi Hanan Wasserman was chosen to be the daughter, to marry the daughter of Rameyer Atlas, shows how well-regarded he was. Rabbi Hanan comes, as was customary in those days, to live with his father-in-law for a few years to devote himself to learning. Tradition was, as I think most people listening to us now know, that if you had a Talmud Chacham as a son-in-law, you would commit for a few years of kest, they call it, of supporting him. You could be a rich person and support him, or you could be a rabbi, and this is part of the deal you had with the community, that your future sons-in-law, that they, you know, the salary has to be sufficient to cover them as well. Rav Kook, the same thing. He lived with the Aderis, Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Teyomim, his father-in-law after his marriage. That was standard. It's not just that it was standards, but if you want to get a top student, like a Rabbi Hanan Wasserman or any other top student, you could be a great Rav, like Rav Meir Atlas or someone else, but if you cannot guarantee at least a few years of uninterrupted Torah study, you are not going to get the good chassan. He'll go to someone else, he'll go to some rich person, because these good students, yes, it was important for them to marry the daughter of a great Rav. That also brought yichus. But it was more important for them to be able to devote themselves to learning. And we've seen over and over again among the people we've dealt with, some of the people we've dealt with, they were given 8 years, 10 years. I think Rav Meir Simcha, if I recall, was 8 or 10 years to learn. So it's very nice to have a father-in-law who's a great Torah scholar. But if he's so poor that he can't support you in learning, and the Aderis was not wealthy at all, that's putting it mildly, and Rav Kook did not have such a good place there, and he had to go out and make a living. And that happens had they not been able to support the son-in-law, he needs to go out and make a living. Rav Meir Atlas had another daughter who married Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski. Obviously, these were not the brothers-in-law of Samuel Atlas. This was actually the second marriage for each of them. The Rav Chaim Ozer's second wife, her first marriage was to the brother of the Kovno Rav, Rav Avram Shapiro. And thank you, David Ozy. Thank you for joining us. As I mentioned before you came on, we think that because the reminder didn't go out today, people forgot about tonight, or they're not sure how to sign in. So it's good to see you as well. In 1902, that's after a few years of living with his father-in-law, Rabbi Hanan accepts a position in Belorussia to head a small yeshiva. This came after, we're told, in the hagiography, that he turned down a position in Moscow. His son, Rav Simcha Wasserman, who survives the war, who makes his way to Los Angeles, where he's a Rav there, then Eretz Yisrael, his son, Rav Simcha Wasserman, is quoted in the volume, the Art Scroll volume, but the Art Scroll volume is an English translation and abridgment of the original volume called Or Ochanan. And as I mentioned, I'll show you some differences, published by Aaron Sarosky. It records Rav Simcha Wasserman stating that Rav Hanan Wasserman was asked to become the Rav, the Rabbi of Moscow. I say to you now that this is impossible. It could never have happened. Why couldn't it have happened? No one under 30, he might have been asked to be a dayan. I'm not going to say not. You know, they needed a dayan there to do weddings and divorces and things like that, but not to become the Rav. First of all, no one under 30 years old ever would have been asked to become the Rav of Moscow. And I'm talking about the spiritual Rav. To be the real rabbi of Moscow, you had to be the crown rabbi. And that's, they already had a crown rabbi. But you needed someone who had a secular education. Even the spiritual rabbi, they would not have asked someone, a young man like that. This was a community in Moscow of, I'm not going to say assimilated Jews, because Jews really couldn't assimilate in Russia because the non-Jews were not interested in them assimilating. These were, though, very enlightened Jews, and had the non-Jewish Russians been amenable, you would have had a lot of assimilation. They did not want a rabbi like Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, but they would have needed a dayan, because you always need a dayan to do religious matters. Now, the town where he was Rosh Yeshiva is called Mitzisravi. It's a nothing town, and this was not one of the great yeshivos. I had never heard of the town, and I investigated it a little bit. Well, what you have is a small yeshiva with young students. We call it a yeshiva. It's more like a high school, where this is a feeder school. Those who finish there a few years would go on to one of the great yeshivas. And it would have been a place for locals from the surrounding towns would have been able to come to this yeshiva. It's interesting, though, because in an earlier class, we've spoken in earlier classes, we've spoken about revolutionary sentiments in different yeshivas, in particular in the Telz yeshiva, and feelings of rebellion. This is in particular in 1904, 1905, which then led to the so-called revolution in Russia. The same thing happened in Mitislavi as well in 1904, and we actually have a memoir that describes how a group of students in this yeshiva wanted to learn Russian. Doesn't sound like so revolutionary, but they wanted to learn Russian. And Rabbi Hanan said that this cannot be done as while you're in yeshiva. It can be done before you come to the yeshiva. It can be done after you leave the yeshiva. But when you're in the yeshiva, everything has to be devoted just to Torah study. And 20 students leave the yeshiva. They don't accept what Rabbi Hanan says. They want to learn Russian. And they start learning in one of the shuls. In every town, you'd have a shul. Sometimes you'd have more than one shul. If it's a decent-sized town, you'd have the shul where the rich people are. Then you'd have the shul of the tailors are in one shul. They would lots of different shuls. And they would learn in the shul, but they would come back to the yeshiva when Rabbi Chanan would give shiur. He'd give shiur, let's say, a couple times a week for an hour and a half, let's say. Rabbi Chanan said to them, it's forbidden for you to enter the yeshiva to hear my shiur. If you want to be in the yeshiva, you have to follow my rules, otherwise you cannot. We know, however, that Rabbi Chanan's way of running the yeshiva did not find favor with the locals. We don't have all the details, but we know it didn't find favor, and you'll see what happens in a minute, and it's very important to get along with the local people. Because it's not like today where yeshiva is completely independent. In those days, the yeshiva students, although they lived, let's say they rented rooms, the arrangement was they would eat at people's houses. And that was a form of charity. They'd arrange that you eat one day this person, one day another person. The yeshiva students would later write about how this was quite embarrassing and uncomfortable. Every day they have to go to a different house. Sometimes they go to a very poor house. Only if you were one of the top students and some rich person took a liking to you, you could eat at his house constantly. But if you did not get along with the local community, you'd be in big trouble. Especially in a small community, the locals would not have tolerated what they thought was creating ill will in the community. What happened was, Rabbi Chanan is away. He goes away one time. I don't know how long it was when he was away. Maybe he went to visit his parents, who knows what. And while he's away, a telegram comes to him in the name of the town Rav. Now, in the memoir that I'm referring to, it says that the Rav was pressured into sending this. Maybe, maybe not, but maybe. I have no reason to doubt it. If the memoir is telling us about the telegram, and the memoir is also telling us that the Rav was pressured into it, I'll take what the memoir says at its face. And the memoir says, in the name of the town Rav, that he should not come back. Rabbi Chanan, you've left. We'll send you your things, but please do not come back to the yeshiva. You're creating machokas in the town. We do not want you here anymore. And because Rabbi Chanan did not want to create machokas, although he still, he was hired to run the yeshiva. He could have gone back. But he did not want to create disputes among the community, which in the end would have led to, he would have had to leave in the end anyway, because if the locals get very upset and they stop donating tzedakah to the yeshiva, if they stop hosting the students, then his position will be untenable. But he does not return. The Rav is named Rav Tzvi Director. D-I-R-E-K-T-O-R would be how you spell it. I know nothing about him. I looked around. I couldn't really find anything about him. I only mention the name because there is a rabbi, a bit of a kitzoni, a kanai, in Brooklyn named Rav Shaya Director. He's a bit of an extremist on one hand. On the other hand, he wrote many kontrasim about Erevin and was very liberal when it came to Erev. But other than this Rav Tzvi Director, the only director I know is this Rav Shaya Director. And I don't know if there's any relation to them, the two. Okay. When I once was allowed to look in the papers of Rav Moshe Feinstein, this is going back 25 years, I actually was trying to look for material from Yaakov Weinberg, and I did find one or two letters. I found, talk about chutzpah, I found a letter from Shaya Director, who had battled with Rav Moshe over various things, writing to him saying that Rav Moshe's support for not just Rav Moshe, but all these other schools, like in Berlin, and Torah Vadas, who allow to go their students to go to university at night, that this is a complete disgrace, and calling on Rav Moshe to do something about it. So following Rav Hanan's, let's say his removal or his resignation as the Rosh Yeshiva, he decides at age 32, which is really past the age of where most people are making these sorts of decisions, but he's free. To go to Radin to study with the Chavetz Chaim. And this would become the most important step in his life. He leaves his wife, who she would have worked, although we don't know what type of job she had. In those days, the women worked. That was pretty standard in those days for the women to work in some way, although today we have this Victorian idea that the man has to take care of the woman. In Eastern Europe, it was, you needed the wives to work. Usually needed both of them to work. Why did he go to the Chavetz Chaim? Other than the fact that the Chavetz Chaim is the Chavetz Chaim, but the Chavetz Chaim had a kollel there where they studied kachim, the laws of sacrifices, the future Beis Hamikdash. They didn't only study kachim. They studied everything, obviously, but there was a focus on kachim, and the Chavetz Chaim pushed this. He himself was a Kohen. So this was near and dear to his heart. He thought that the Messianic era was imminent. If you recall the classes we had on the Nazir, on Rav David Cohen, how Rav David Cohen, whose grandfather, it was maternal grandfather, if I recall, was the Rav of Radin. The Chavetz Chaim was not the Rav of Radin, although he had a yeshiva there, and he wasn't like a typical Rosh Yeshiva, but it was his yeshiva, and then he had this kollel. But if you recall the Chavetz Chaim learnt with Rav David Cohen, the Nazir, when he came to live with his grandfather, and the Chavetz Chaim said to him that it's important that he learn the laws of Kachim and the Beis HaMikdash, because although I may not live to see the coming of the Messiah, you will live and you need to be prepared. Since I just mentioned the Chavetz Chaim as not being the Rav of a town, let me just add something. If you look in my latest Svarim blog post, I quoted Rav Moshe Feinstein. First, I quoted Rav Henkin as saying that in a dispute between the Chavetz Chaim, that is the Mishnah Brura, and the Aruch HaShulchan, he decided like the Aruch HaShulchan, because the Aruch HaShulchan was a communal Rav who had to deal with all these matters. And the communal Rav, his psak goes ahead of Rosh Yeshiva. Then I quoted an email I received from a relative, a close relative. I don't want to say who it is because I haven't given permission, or haven't asked him actually. Of Rav Moshe Feinstein saying that he heard the exact same thing from Rav Moshe Feinstein. He heard it, he went with him in the mountains and in the Lower East Side, and that you go by the Chavetz Chaim, by the Aruch HaShulchan. And he said that when he told this to Rabbi David Zucker, who's Rosh Kollel in Chicago, Rabbi Zucker said that he heard the exact same thing from the Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that the Aruch HaShulchan takes precedence over the Mishnah Brura. And that's not surprising. We've heard many, many people heard this from Rav Moshe. In one of the last comments to this blog post, someone writes in that he apparently checked with Rav David Feinstein. Rav David Feinstein denies it. It couldn't have happened. His father never said such a thing. And then someone writes in saying whether Rav David says this or not is really irrelevant, because many people, including rabbis, we're told the exact same thing from Rav Moshe Feinstein, that the Aruch HaShulchan takes precedence. Now, I don't know it's a little hard for me to imagine, or David said this, but he's quoted as saying, and all I can say is that if he knew who it was, well, I'm not talking about some distant cousin, I'm talking about someone mamish in the close family. If Rav David Feinstein knew who told me this, who heard it directly from Moshe, and forget all the other rabbis, believe me, I've gotten emails. There's plenty of other rabbis who've heard this from Moshe. But if Rav David Feinstein knew who it was who said this, I don't think he would say, my father never said this. I'm not quoting some Joe Schmo who said, I heard from Moshe where there's a million people. Well, that's all I want to say. It's mamish inside the family, closer to Rav David than he realizes. Let's just put it that way. So he goes to Radin, and he becomes, as I said, very close to the Chavetz Chaim, is greatly influenced by him, and sees him as his Rebbe Muvak, as for the rest of his life. He would return every year to spend the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and actually through Sukkot. Just like you do with Chassidus Rebbe, he would spend it together with the Chafetz Chaim. Rav Ochanan went so far as to say that the Chafetz Chaim marked the end of an era, the period of the Achronim. After the Chafetz Chaim, and he said this in the Chafetz Chaim's time, when the Chafetz Chaim passed away, he said it marks the end of an era, which is the era of the Achronim. Other people did not think that. In retrospect, where we are today, I think most people would agree that with the passing of the Mishnah Berurah, actually, let me take that back. I don't know if that's the case. When I was in yeshiva, we were told that really the Mishnah Berurah was the end of an era. But, you know, you think of Moshe Feinstein. He argued with the Mishnah Berurah. He didn't feel like he had to follow the Mishnah Berurah. Someone said to me that it's perhaps in the future years we'll see that the end of the 20th century, the passing of Moshe Feinstein, really, is that the end of one year or the beginning of another? It's hard to say. You really can't make this determination in your time. It's only 100 years, 150 years later that people look back and say that this is the end of an era. You can't really say that, you know, when the Rishonim end, when the Achronim begin. It's somewhere around the Radbaz. Is the Radbaz a late Rishon, an early Achron? Maybe the Shulchan Aruch is the beginning of the Achronim. But then again, the Shulchan Aruch, if he's an Achron, he's a very different sort of Achron than the Mishnah Berurah. But that's what Rav Ochanan thought, that the end of an era came with the passing of Chafetz Chaim. But that's already not to 1933. And we're still at the beginning of the 20th century. After spending a good time with the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Ochanan is offered a new job, this time in Brisk. And this is where I assert that he becomes close to Rav Chaim, because as I mentioned, the evidence that we have, or at least the evidence that I found, shows that he had two intense summers with Rav Chaim, 1897 to 1898. Other than that, there's no evidence of any real exposure to Rav Chaim. And yet from 1910, that's when he becomes what we call a Ben Bayis. That's when he's with Rav Chaim nonstop, constantly. And when Rav Chaim when he's quoting Rav Chaim, I mean, we're talking about a time where Rav Ochanan was with him literally every single day, except for those times when Rav Chaim would go like on vacation. Sometimes they go to these resorts where the different gedolim would go to. And that's where he really became close to, not just Rav Chaim, became close to Rav Elvel, became close to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik as well. In 1910, he comes to head the yeshiva Letzeirim. There's a yeshiva for young people, again, just like he was other yeshiva, not a yeshiva gedola, but a yeshiva for young people to, and then they'd 14, 15, 16, 17, and then from there you move on to the yeshiva gedola. There were people, older people, more mature people studying in Brisk. There are people who studied with Rav Chaim, sort of on an unofficial way. They just came to study with him. But there were other yeshivas in town. Rav Unterman, for example, as we saw, studied in Brisk. You had Rav Simcha Zelig in Brisk who would teach people. So you had other things going on. But this was really like an elementary, early high school. He remains there 4 years with Rav Chaim. This yeshiva closes, however, in World War I, and that's when people scatter. Rav Chaim ends up going to Minsk, and he passes away in Minsk. Why didn't Rav Chaim go to his son, Rav Moshe, who who was at this time in Chasavich. There's all sorts of stories about this. What I heard from Rav Golevsky, who's him and Rav Steinman are, I think, the last two rabbis, last two members of the Torah community of Brisk who are alive today. Or really change, let me alter that. Last two rabbanim, and Rav Steinman is not just a rav, he's for the Haredi, Ashkenaz Haredi world, he's the final Das Torah, but him and Rav Golevsky are the final rabbanim who are born in Brisk and could tell you about the community in Brisk before the war. It's good that Rav Steinman can tell us about this. If you go on YouTube, I can send in one of the link, you have a video there where these people came because they had these extremists who didn't want certain families, or one family in particular, if I recall, to allow to send their kids to this yeshiva in Jerusalem or Bnei Brak, I don't remember which one. And believe me, this family wasn't a family. It's not like they had a TV or something. They were definitely Haredi, but just not of a certain type. And Rav Steinman recalls how in Brisk, everyone, including, the children of Rav Elval, had to go to school together with the sweat hogs, to use a 70s term. And it didn't hurt them, it didn't affect them. And Rav Steinman gets very angry, and he says, it's gaiva. These people have gaiva. They think the whole world revolves around them, and that they can control who can go to yeshiva. And Rav Steinman asks them, what's this kid supposed to do then? They're not going to let him in the yeshiva. Where is he supposed to go? And that's Rav Steinman at his best. If you haven't seen this video, I highly recommend it. And it's precisely this video and things like that, which is the reason why some people in the Haredi world don't like Rav Steinman. And one day I'll write about this, but they actually use this video to show that he's not a real leader. Precisely because he doesn't understand that in the Haredi school, you can't have people if they're not 100% like you. What did I hear from Rav Golevsky? He said, I think this is above Meister. Rav Golevsky, you should live and be well, has a lot of good history, but he also has a lot of above Meisters, and they're all mixed together, so you don't know what's true, what's not. He said that Reb Chaim was very upset with Reb Moshe for taking the shtela in Chasavich because it was a Chabad city. And therefore, he didn't want to go there. I find that hard to believe. And first of all, I don't know of any history of negative feelings of Reb Chaim for Chabad. But he didn't like the fact that when Reb Soloveitchik came as a youngster to see Reb Chaim, all he knew was Tanya. That's he didn't like, but the idea that he didn't want to be in the city, which was Chabad, that I've never heard, and it sounds a bit like a bub myself. So he goes to Minsk, and he dies in Minsk. Rav Ochanan does not follow Rav Chaim, which shows you something as well. Although he loved Rav Chaim and gained enormous amount from him, he goes to the Chavetz Chaim. He goes back to Radin to be with the Chavetz Chaim, and the Radin yeshiva soon has to leave Radin as well. Or at least most of it left. Part of it remained in Radin, and most, including the Chavetz Chaim and Rav Ochanan, move east, deeper into Russia, where the yeshiva was reestablished, and Rav Ochanan is involved with the yeshiva. He doesn't just teach in this yeshiva, he actually helps it to survive. He's involved in running it. While on the way to the east, something unbelievable happens. And this, you can find it in on page 84 in the Art Scroll book, and it's also in the Sarovsky volume. And it comes from Rav Simcha Wasserman, who was there. So we have an eyewitness testimony to this. This isn't some story he's telling you that he heard that his father was offered the position of the Rav of Moscow. He was there. They were traveling by train as they're moving east, and it was Friday afternoon, and the Chavetz Chaim announces, we're getting off the train right now, and we're going to spend Shabbos in the middle here. It's not a town. It's just one of these places in the fields. They're going to get off. There's no Jewish community there, so I guess there was a stop. And they would just spend it there. And as the book points out, this seems to contradict the halakha that, you know, saving lives supersedes the Shabbos. They're already on the train. You know, they should just stay on the train. But the Chafetz Chaim said, and according to everyone, that should be the halakha. What's the problem? But especially since it's, your life is in danger in Russia, to remain in an open field like that as a Jew, and you got off before Shabbos. The problem is, the problem is that the train is going to stop on Shabbos, so you'd have to get off. But what's the problem again? If it's a matter of life and death here, you can't get off in the middle. They asked Rav Chafetz Chaim, how can we get off here? Pikuach nefesh. The Chafetz Chaim replied that of course danger to life supersedes the Shabbos, and therefore the other people could stay on and should stay on the train. However, he said, Chil Hashem, profaning the name of God, does not set aside Shabbos. And he says, if I were to continue traveling on the train and arrive in the city and get on Shabbos, the unlearned people would assume that everything was permissible in wartime. That is, they would assume, hey, the Chafetz Chaim is riding around trains on Shabbos. I too can get on a train, and they wouldn't make the distinction that pikuach nefesh you can, other times you can't, and therefore in order to prevent what would lead to a chil Hashem, that is, by chil Hashem, that is, people would draw incorrect conclusions about Shabbos and how to observe Shabbos from the Chafetz Chaim's actions. Therefore, he said that he has to take the risk to his life, but he said everyone else must stay on the train. That is, they're to light Shabbos candles on the train and continue their journey. Rabbi Chanan, however, says that he and his family are remaining with the Chafetz Chaim while everyone else goes ahead. And the book describes how they spent the Shabbos under the open sky, and they were confronted by non-Jews and soldiers, but everything was okay. At around 4 a.m., however, that's 4 a.m. Shabbos morning, this Rabbi Mordechai Reuchblatt, who I don't know who he is, who was with this group, he was with Rabbi Chanan the Chafetz Chaim, he leaves on Shabbos and grabs a train and goes to the nearest community, that is where they were intending on going. But Molodechno, which was the closest town to where they were, and they couldn't get there for Shabbos, he grabs a train and he goes there on Shabbos, and he announces that the Chafetz Chaim is in danger. And it says that he, and this is Rav Simcha Wasserman, he and the head of the community hire a horse and wagon and go out on Shabbos to find the Chafetz Chaim, but it turns out that they don't reach the Chafetz Chaim until Shabbos is already over anyway, and the Chafetz Chaim, his wish of not having to travel on Shabbos was fulfilled, and therefore he comes to this town Saturday night. But it's really an incredible story. They leave the next day, and German army conquers it 2 days later, which, I don't know, is not necessarily a bad thing. In World War I, the people who were conquered by Germany, things were actually good for them. When you read this, it says they left the morning after, and 2 days later, Molodechno was captured by the Germans. People who lived through that time recall the German soldiers as being so polite. The German army was... the whole chaplaincy was an Orthodox chaplaincy, or the leadership of it. The German Orthodox community was very tight with the German government and the German army, and everywhere the German army conquered, the Orthodox chaplains came. So you actually want to be where German occupied territory is. You don't want to be under the Russians. But they were not sure. People did not realize. So they knew there's a war, and they didn't want to be caught in the battles, so they went east. And the yeshiva remains in Russia, that is the main part of the Radin Yeshiva, through the Communist Revolution, 1918, and it would have remained there. However, by 1921, the anti-religious persecution in the Soviet Union was too much. Mostly this persecution was by the Jewish communists. Later on, of course, the Russian government itself would adopt this position, but in the early years, they had bigger fish to fry. They were fighting a civil war against what's called the whites, as the Reds versus the whites, and they were not so concerned whether there was a mikvah or whether there was a shul. That would come in later years. But the Jewish communists, they made it their goal to shut down religious life. And therefore, they decided to, the Radin Yeshiva would return to Poland. And they did. And this was done legally. In those early years, you could transfer legally. No, I thought that if I find something interesting here about this. And the first stop, if you take a look at a map, the first stop, the border just now is a little different, but then the first stop, or one of the first stops, very close to the border, was a Polish town, not a significant town, but a Polish town called Baranowicz. Baranowicz only became part of Poland in 1919 as a result of the... the new borders. In 1921, Baranowicz has 11,000 inhabitants. Well, not a very big, but not a very small town. If you think in terms of towns, a decent sized town in those days in Poland. But 67% of the town was Jewish. And this is not the only such town. There were a number of towns that were majority Jewish in Poland and in Russia. There were towns which had no Jews, but the majority of the town was Jewish. Today, the city, if you look on the map, you can find it. It's in Belorussia. This city, town, I should say, city of a town of 11,000, had a yeshiva already, a small yeshiva, and it was called Ohel Torah. And Rabbi Chanan takes over it, or you could say he reestablished it, because it wasn't really existing. It had existed before the war, and it really wasn't existing when he comes to the town, but people are interested, so he reestablishes it. This also, people talk about the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe, and sometimes they'll mention Baranowicz. They'll say Sobotka, Mir, Baranowicz. Baranowicz should not be mentioned in the same breath as Telz and Sobotka and Mir and Ponevezh, because, again, it is a feeder school, a feeder yeshiva for the great yeshivas. It has an elementary school, the Yeshiva Katana, and then it has a high school-type yeshiva from which students would go on to the great yeshivot. Today in America, we call yeshivas, even for little kids, we call it Yeshiva Katana. They would be called cheder in Europe, but... sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, so that you can call the yeshiva katana, and then you can have an older yeshiva where kids are 16, 17, maybe even 18, and from there you would move on to the great yeshivas, the yeshivas whose names we all know. There were probably more students in the great yeshivas, by which I mean Mir, Telz, Sobotka, those are really the great yeshivas, Ponevezh, a couple others, Novartek maybe. The Rav Shimon Shkups, had a yeshiva. Luzhin wasn't really a great yeshiva after the war. After it closed down and reopened again. But you have the yeshivas. You probably had more students in the yeshivas who came from Baranowicz than any other place. It was a very important feeder school. And it was a Musar yeshiva. Even though it wasn't the yeshiva at the same level, or the Bachrim were not the same age, as you'll find in a place like Sobotka, it was a Musar yeshiva, complete with a mashgiach. A mashgiach, that is the one who's in charge of Musar. And it had regular Musar shiurim, what they call shmuzin. During this period in Baranowicz, when he's Rosh Yeshiva, and as Rosh Yeshiva Baranowicz, he, of course, teaches shiurim, but he also was responsible for raising money, which was an enormous burden on him, and which leads him to come to America, as we'll soon see. He even, with all the other stuff he had to do, raising money primarily, and teaching Torah, he published a journal called, not surprisingly, Ohel Torah. But only the first volume was edited by Rabbi Chanan. I guess it became too difficult to edit it, so he gave it to other people to edit it. But in the second issue, you actually have an article by a man named Rav Shlomo Hyman, if anyone knows this name. It becomes an important name in America because he comes to Rav Chaim Berlin, to Yeshivas Rav Chaim Berlin. Not Chaim Berlin, Tar Vadas. He's one of the great East European Rosh Yeshivas. He was teaching in Baranowicz at this period. one common theme of Rav Yochanan's days in Baranovich was poverty. Constantly the mention of poverty, not just for him, but for the yeshiva as a whole. I mean, he really, really suffered. And it isn't just something other people write about. I heard this from Ben Sion Wacholder. Ben Sion Wacholder passed away a few years ago, learned in Baranovich. He later gets a secular education, and he ends up teaching at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, just like Samuel Atlas. I don't know whether he remained an observant Jew or not. He was an East European Talmud Chacham who taught Talmud and has some important publications. I spoke to him on the phone, but I can't say religiously where he was. But he told me that incredible. He just told me about the incredible poverty. We don't know this sort of poverty today. That Rav Yochanan, he lived the way he lived. There was another yeshiva in Baranovich, not just Ohel Torah, and this was a yeshiva established by a man named Rav Avraham Weinberg, who, if you don't know who that is, he is the Slonimer Rebbe. Slonim is a Hasidus from Lita, or I guess it's considered Lita. This yeshiva combined both traditional Torah study and Hasidut, which is unusual because you don't have Lithuanian Torah study at a Hasidish yeshiva. There were also, by the way, Hasidic students this is technically Poland, but it's Jewish Lithuania. But you had Hasidic students in Rav Yochanan's yeshiva. And the Gera Rebbe encouraged students who wanted to go there. And because of that, it's in Yonah Dioma today, although I mentioned, if you haven't heard it, I recommend people who are interested in the practices of Nittel, of Torah Study Christmas Eve, to listen to the Torah in Motion talk I gave a few years ago on this. And by the way, you'll see in my next foreign blog post, a new article on this topic has come out came out last year. But the Lithuanian yeshivas would learn Christmas Eve, just like any other day, just like today. I mean, if you go in a couple days, if you go to the Lakewood Yeshiva, they'll be learning on Nittel. Maybe some Hasidic students won't be, but everyone else will be. Ben Sion Wacholder told me that the yeshiva as a whole did not learn Christmas Eve. There's no question that Rav Yochanan Wasserman at home would be learning, and other people would be learning, but the yeshiva itself did not learn, and he said the reason was because there was all these Hasidim in the yeshiva. And I guess they didn't want to offend them or whatever it was, or they didn't want to make them feel like they were left out if everyone else is learning and they're not learning. But as far as I know, Baranovich is the only Lithuanian yeshiva which on Nittel they did not learn. In the biography of Rav Yochanan, it gives... it describes him at Baranovich. And we have many, many people who studied there, who left descriptions, and there are still people alive. But one of the descriptions, actually this is not a description, this comes from Rav Simcha Wasserman. He quotes Rav Yochanan as saying that Rav Simcha Wasserman, about his father, that there are two traits that distinguish him throughout his life, and you saw this when he was in Baranovich. He had a great sense of duty to his students, to take care of them, and two, quote, an iron self-discipline that enabled him to rise above personal emotion, be it elation or grief. That's a sort of a brisker characteristic. I don't know if it's a Litvisher characteristic per se, but I don't know if that's a good thing. That's a characteristic, but it's written here as if this is a positive thing. I don't know. We have plenty of examples of Rosh Yeshiva who were very emotional and felt grief and things like that. So I'm not sure that that's a good trait. I'm not saying it's a bad trait either. I just think it's maybe just a trait. I don't think that you're a better Rosh Yeshiva if, the description here says... an iron self-discipline that allows you to rise above personal emotion, be it elation or grief. Maybe for some people that's the better characteristic in a Rebbe, and other people would think just the opposite. I've had Rebbeim who were very emotional, and you know, you felt it, and that was good for some, and others who were all brain and no heart. To each their own. Rav Chaim, by the way, was not like Rav Elvel and the Rav. Rav Chaim was a raconteur. Rav Chaim was, he was full of emotion. So when you speak about briskers, it's not Rav Chaim. In his lifetime of important Talmudic writings, among the works he published, and I guess the most important ones, were his Kovetz Ha'aros on Yevamos, that is his collection of comments on Tractate Yevamot, and two volumes of what's called Kovetz Shiurim, collection of Shiurim. If from this title you would think that this is like the Kovetz Shiurim of many other great Rabbanim we have, of Gustman or any number of others, when you read them, they go on for pages and pages, and they're Shiurim. There's, they take their Shiurim and they put it down. But it's not. It's, even though they're called Kovetz Shiurim, most of it, if you look at it, is a commentary on the daf, on the page, page after page. The first part of Volume 2 has commentaries in the form of what we call simanim, that is, sections, which is more of like a shiur put into print. But the rest is just a commentary on the daf. You see in the Kovetz Shiurim, it's some interesting things. For example, he shows a critical sense, which is not typical of Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. For example, he discusses various works of Rishonim, medieval authorities, that were incorrectly attributed. For example, he says that the commentary of Rabbeinu Gershom, that's printed in Tractate with Tractate Kritut, that's not by Rav Gershom. It's actually a version of Rashi. He says that the Chidushim on Masechet Shabbat attributed to the Ran are not by him. He says the Chidushim attributed to the Ritva are really by the Ran. To be able, and what he said, as far as I know, has been supported by the academic scholars to look at these matters, but you really need to be a great scholar, like Rav Chanan was, to be able to look at pages of a text and say it's not written by the Ritva. It's written, let's say, by the Ran. So that's of significance. I will come back to some of his Talmudic ideas in a little bit. I want to continue with the biography and tell you that, that I'm not sure where it comes from, but Rav Chanan always had an aspect of him that was a kanai, zealot, as we'll see, kitzoni, extremist, extremist compared to the other Lithuanian Rabbanim. If he was in Hungary, he wouldn't be regarded as extremist. But it is true that he is different than the other Lithuanian Rabbanim. And just to give you one example, before we'll see some really important examples when we deal with his view of Zionism and his strong stand in that. But there was a Sefer Yovel. Rav Shimon Shkop was the elder Rosh Yeshiva in Lithuania. Shimon Shkop, who had been at different yeshivas, he came to America, there for 1 year, and he was in Grodno. Other places before that, he was in Telz. He opened up a yeshiva, or he headed the yeshiva, Shari Torah in Grodno, and that yeshiva continues to this day, or at least a continuation of it, in Queens. Rav Zelig Epstein, who, if I'm not mistaken, is the grandson or great-grandson, I don't know, there's some relation to him and Rav Shimon Shkop. Rav Shimon Shkop is one of the great, great Rosh Yeshiva of Eastern Europe. Unfortunately, Yeshiva College, Reach, could not hold on to him. Apparently, the Chafetz Chaim told him that he has to return, because if he doesn't come back, the Yeshiva in Grodno will disintegrate. But the Yeshiva was suffering financially terribly, and they wanted to come up with a way to raise money. And by doing that, they wanted to create, put the focus on Rav Shimon Shkop. So let people know who he is, and that would help him raise money. And the idea was to publish a Sefer Yovel. What's a Sefer Yovel? Well, Sefer Yovel is what we call in English a Jubilee volume. It's a common thing for outstanding scholars. They get a Jubilee volume in their honor. Unfortunately, sometimes if they don't live long enough, it becomes a Sefer Zikaron. I know Professor Isidore Torsky, Yitzhak Torsky, he actually has two of them. They both began, as a Sefer Yovel, and he passed away, so it became a Sefer Zikaron, a memorial volume. And they came up with this idea to do a Sefer Yovel, a Jubilee volume, which Big Rabbanim would contribute Torah articles in honor of Rav Shimon. And this would, as I said, the book would be sent all over the world, and people would respond by sending in donations to honor the great Rav Shimon, the senior Rosh Hashiva of our time. Rabbi Chanan, what could be wrong with this? Rabbi Chanan refuses to contribute an essay to the Sefer HaYovel, even though all the other great Rabbanim of the time are contributing. The Sefer Yovel, why they call it Sefer Yovel? Today, it's often they call it a Jubilee volume. Jubilee just means, you know, you've done great work for so many years, we're going to give it to you. But in this case, it really was a Sefer Yovel. It was time to commemorate 50 years of Rav Shimon being a Rosh Yeshiva. But Rabbi Chanan would not contribute to it. And Rabbi Chanan was a Talmud of Rav Shimon. Rabbi Chanan, when he was in Telz, was a student of Rav Shimon. And yet he refused to contribute to the Sefer Yovel in honor of his Rebbe because he says it's not Minhag Yisrael, it's not the practice of Jews to have this thing called a Sefer Yovel, and this is not an honor to Rav Shimon. We have to find a different way to do it. The fact that you all are doing it, I won't contribute to something that I think departs from the tradition Minhag Yisrael. And it's true, it's not Minhag Yisrael. But on the other hand, it's not opposed to Minhag Yisrael, I don't think. It's not like a statue, where we know a statue we don't do, and that's not Minhag Yisrael. It's actually, halachically, it's a problem. You can't do it. But it's not a negative thing. It's just something we haven't done. But from Rabbi Hanan's very conservative outlook, if it wasn't done, that's a reason not to do it. Rabbi Chaim Ozer seems to be responding, if not to Rabbi Hanan, to others in his introduction, where he says that it's true that in previous generations we did not do this thing of a Sefer Yovel. He says, but, you know, we're dealing with Rabbi Shimon here, and it's very important, you know, his yeshiva, and we have to do what we can to assist him, and this is a good way we can do this. And therefore, we're going to do it. Not long after this, I believe it was 19... I forget the year, actually. I think it was even before this, in 1935, in those days, they thought the Rambam was born in 1135. Now we know that he was actually born in 1138. But in 1935, when people still didn't realize that, the date appears, and I'll talk about this summer when we go to Cordoba. But it appears in the Arabic translation of his commentary on the Mishnah, which people didn't have access to really in the 1930s. So in 1935, there were all these celebrations, and there were Jews all over were making celebrations in honor of the Rambam, and they published volumes in honor of the Rambam. They called it Sefer Yovel for the Rambam. And the yeshiva world almost uniformly refused to involve themselves, to contribute. And they said, this is not how we memorialize and celebrate the Rambam, by celebrating his birthday and doing books in his honor. But when it came to 1205, which was the anniversary of his Yahrzeit, I didn't see any such objections. There was all sorts of volumes. But I think the reason was because you had a lot of the non-religious who were making a big deal about it. But the same sort of approach was Rabbi Chanan, and Rabbi Chaim Ozer acknowledges that we didn't do this in the past, but it's important to do it now because this will help in raising funds. And subsequent to that time, Sefer Yovels become very common, and there even was a book about 10 years ago called Sefer Yovel for the Chasam Sofer. How could you have Sefer Yovel for the Chasam Sofer? He passed away so long ago. But the point was to collect articles focusing on his Torah in his honor. All the great Lithuanian Rabbanim these days have volumes which are either called Sefer Yovel, which are Sefer Yovels, even if they don't call it that. They say Sefer L'chavod, to honor, or Zicharon, or in memory of so-and-so. All the great Rabbanim have these volumes today. When Rav Shimon had it, no one did, and actually Rav Shimon Shkaf is the first of the great rabbis to have a volume in his honor. Rabbi Chanan was among those asked by Rav Shimon Schwab. Rav Shimon Schwab, Simon Schwab, was a yeshiva student from, he came from Frankfurt. His family, he was from Frankfurt. It was a city, Ichenshausen, which is right outside it. I think that's where he ends up going, his first rabbinic position. But he's from the Frankfurt Kehila, Torah Derech Eretz. And we all know that the Frankfurt community believed in Torah and the best of Western civilization. The problem was that, in the 1920s, continuing into the 1930s, you had a whole group of students from Germany, all over Germany, who went east, went to the yeshivas, to Telz yeshiva, Sabbatka, all these great yeshivas in the east. Just like today, they go to the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. And when they came back, just like today, we have a phenomenon of people coming back and firmer than their parents, and flipping out is the term that people use today, although, as I mentioned before, when I was in Israel, they didn't have such a term. You had the same sort of phenomenon. You had this flipping out, people coming back to Germany. They no longer want anything to do with this German bourgeois lifestyle of their parents. They don't want to go to the opera, and they don't want to read Schiller and Goethe and listen to German music and anything. In fact, they even started an organization called Torah Umusar, not Torah Derech Eretz. And that had all sorts of effects on the young Orthodox community. One of these people was Rabbi Shimon Schwab, who had spent time, a good deal of time, in Eastern Europe, and he actually spent time, some time with the Chafetz Chaim. He comes back to Germany and he's completely disillusioned by this German Jewish lifestyle, which, although was completely observant, very observant, the Frankfurt community that he came from was very, very halachic. The women wore shadels there, which was not the case in other places in Germany, and definitely wasn't the case in Eastern Europe. I mean, completely halachic, but they were very ignorant. Jewish education was not important, and they were religious, pious balabatim, but Torah study was not central to their lives. What did they do? They reviewed the Parsha with Hirsch's commentary, but to actually be able to sit and learn, like we think today, balabatim, that was not part of their culture. And Rav Shimon Schwab saw that the reason that he wanted to change the culture, but the problem was Torah Derech Eretz, this idea that everyone needs to go to the university, and it's an important value to be enmeshed with German culture and German civilization. Coming from Eastern Europe, that is one of the yeshivas in Eastern Europe, coming back to Germany, he had a completely different approach, and he was opposed to this ideology. And he sends a letter to a number of East European rabbanim, asking them their opinion on the German lifestyle of Torah Derech Eretz, hoping that they're going to tell him that this is absolutely forbidden, and then he could begin his method of tearing down Torah Derech Eretz. So this is where I'm going to stop, because this is quite an issue that we're going to see, and since I just told you about Rav Hanan's extremism, I think you'll be surprised that in this area he was not so extreme when it came to Rav Shimon Schwab's question. But we will pick up with this. We will meet again, God willing. I think it's maybe first week in February. This semester has been 7 classes. I thank all of you listening live. As I mentioned, we have a smaller group today because they forgot to send out the reminder. But all of you, and it's many, many more who listen by tape, I thank you. Keep sending me the comments. And as I say always, that I get more out of your comments and questions than sometimes in my own study. So thank you all for joining me this semester. I'll stay on for another couple minutes if the people we have here, if anyone has any questions or comments, but we will pick up next semester with Rabbi Chanan. We have good things to do. We have Rabbi Chanan and Torah Derech Eretz. We have Rabbi Chanan. I'm going to go through the Agudas Yisrael convention at Marienbad, where the issue of Zionism was front and center, and you had the mainstream position, and then you had Rabbi Chanan, who tried to push a different position. You will see the anti-Zionism of Rabbi Chanan, and you'll see who joins Rabbi Chanan's side in this. and then we'll talk about some of the other important disputes and aspects of Rabbi Yochanan's life. We'll pick up with the biography. Rabbi Yochanan, of course, is one of the greatest of the Kedoshim, of the martyrs of the Holocaust. Others, such as Rabbi Baruch Baer, Leibovitz, Rav Shimon, Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, they pass away natural deaths before the Nazi era. But of those Rabbanim who were martyred in the Holocaust, I don't think any of them is greater than Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. If you think of the Rabbanim, and many were martyred, including great Rabbanim, Menachem Zemba, Rav Aaron Valkin of Pinsk. I was in Young Israel of West Hempstead 2 weeks ago, and the rabbi of that shul, Rabbi Yehuda Kellermer, who maybe is the greatest Talmud Chacham of a pulpit rabbi in America. But his wife's grandfather was Rav Aaron Valkin, the Rav of Pinsk, the Zakan Aaron, and he was martyred. So there's no end to the number of great Torah figures who were martyred in the Holocaust, but I don't think anyone really is at the level of Rabbi Yochanan, so we'll talk about that, and there's a good deal more, and then I hope to, because I was asked to do this, I wasn't planning on doing this, I was planning to move on to another sage, and I do want to do Rav Shimon Shkop, I want to do Rav Rafael Levitz, but I had a request to, because some people, actually it was not from one, it was from two or three people, they really enjoyed the Rav Avad Yosef early years, so I was asked to do the middle years. So I'm going to probably spend a few classes on the middle years of Rav Avadya. And I think it's only fair also to focus a little on the Sephardic world. And then I want to come back to the heart of Lithuania again with Rav Baruch Leibovitz, with Rav Shimon Shkop, maybe with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and others. Yisrael asks, when people like Rav Chaim and Chavetz Chaim spend time with Rav Wasserman or Rav Schwab, is that because they are mentoring young promising scholars and future leaders? Or could anyone have popped in and spent time with them? It's the latter. As true Rabbanim, their doors were always open. You could always, plenty of people went to see the Chavetz Chaim. You could see him, you could knock on his door and talk to him. Ritzvi Yehuda Kook goes to see him, and the Chavetz Chaim, it's a great, Ritzvi Yehuda told the story. The Chavetz Chaim made up a bed, and Ritzvi Yehuda stayed with the Chavetz Chaim. You could go see him, you could go see, it's not like today, they didn't have gatekeepers, they didn't have people you had to go be. Of course, the religious world is much smaller. I mean, if you didn't have the gatekeepers around these big rabbis, they would never have a chance to learn. You'd have the Vol Yashev would have 20, 30 people every day coming to see him, and they'd fill up his room. You had to have gatekeepers. You didn't have that. Just think, I mean, Jerusalem is the center of the Jewish life. You have, think of all the Jews who live in Jerusalem, and every day, hundreds of tourists, you know, Shishivish people are coming to Jerusalem. Everyone sees Rav Yashav. What was Radin? Radin was a little nothing, hole in the wall. You can go on a tour today, a Schneer Lyman summer tour. You know, it's a few blocks, and who would go to Radin? You had Shiva students, and once in a while, someone would make the trek to see the Chavetz Chaim. We're not talking about Vienna or Berlin or anything like that. These were small, tiny towns. Anyone could come in, could go to shul, could see the rabbi, could talk to him, could go to his house. It was very, very different. And the Torah world itself was much smaller in those days. Those who are interested in seeing pictures of Rabbanim, I could send the link to you. They just posted yesterday previously unknown video, about 2.5 minutes, video from the Agudas Yisrael Convention in Vienna in 1923. Apparently Rabbi Yulia Young is in one of those pictures. I just looked through it very quickly, so I didn't get a chance to identify him. And there's a couple of rabbis with long beards. I can't tell who they are. One is clearly Yaakov Rosenheim, who's not a rabbi, but who's the head of the Aguda. But I'm hoping that one of the Hebrew sites picks up on this, and actually, because there's a Hebrew site, it's titled Rabbi HaRabbanim Bitmuna, and it goes on for like 15 pages, full of pictures of rabbis who we don't know who they are, and then the people comment and say, this is Rabbi X, Rabbi Y, and so I'm waiting for someone to start commenting on that picture. One of the great things is there's a great video of the rabbi, of the march on Washington, of the rabbis. When the Orthodox rabbis marched on Washington during the Holocaust, I always wondered who these rabbis were. I know who Rav Eliezer Silver is, but who the rest are. So if you go to that website, they identify, they have different strains of it, who the different rabbis are. So it's a great website, and I'd like someone to identify who some of these rabbis are in this picture. in this video, not just a picture. Talking about pictures, when in the foreword, they did a piece on Moshe Tursky, and they showed a picture of Isidore Tursky's wedding with Rav Soloveitchik and the Tolner Rebbe, and there's two Tolner Rebbes. That picture, I put that picture on the Svarim blog, if you remember. If not, I'll send you the link. And I identified who the various rabbis are in that picture. It then went to someone else who passed it on to the forward who used that picture. Another question. I wonder if Rabbi Hanan's sympathy for the Rav came in part from his association with Rav Chaim or Moshe Soloveitchik. I'm referring to Rav Chanoch Cohen's quoting of him saying, "I don't know why people complain about Rav Soloveitchik. I was there in Boston and never saw him eat or sleep." Yes, when we went through this, and when I told you at first that I found it hard to believe, knowing Rabbi Hanan, that he would actually have such a positive view, you provided the documentation for it, and I think so. I would assume so. Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibovitz, who also was no lover of Zionism, he was a great defender of Moshe Soloveitchik. When a group of, and I mentioned this already in a previous class, when a group of Lithuanian Rabbanim wanted to put Moshe Soloveitchik in Cheirim, Rabbi Baruch Ber said that you don't put the Rebbe's son in Cheirim. So it could be that's the connection. Rav Soloveitchik also, when Rabbi Hanan came to Boston, it was to raise money for his yeshiva. And the Rav would have been very influential and very helpful in helping him raise money for the yeshiva. Also, I have to say that Rabbi Hanan, with the exception of Rav Kook, and that's going to be quite difficult, I think, for us to stomach, it was not personal at all with him. He went to Ireland, and Rav Herzog hosted him, and Rav Herzog helped him raise money. Rav Herzog is a religious Zionist. Rabbi Hanan thinks religious Zionism is a form of Avodah Zarah. That did not stop him from having a good relationship with Rav Herzog. So it wasn't personal. And Yisrael asks, let's make this the last question. And we'll hold off on the rest to next semester. How could anyone in 1900 know that a town had 10,000 people? How would they count that? Did they do an official census where they went to every person? They had censuses. The Russian government did a census. These censuses were not exact. They weren't exact then. They're not exact now. We saw in Baghdad they had a number. But they know exactly how many people are there. And this is then recorded in various newspapers of the time. Government documents, because everyone pays taxes. So they know how many people are there. That doesn't mean it's exact because they don't necessarily get all the children, just like today. But it's a lot easier to know how many people are there in a small town. And 10,000 is not a small town. There are many towns a lot smaller than that, than it is to know how many in a big city. So yes, they did do censuses for the simple reason that they needed to know how taxes. Everyone had to pay taxes. And therefore, everyone needed to be accounted for. Even before taxes, forget taxes even, and there was a draft. They knew who was in their town. They didn't have computers like we do, and they didn't have cameras, but they knew who was in the city. And they had to know. That was the job of the police, and the secret police, and the bureaucrats. Thank you all very much, and enjoy the rest of Hanukkah, and hopefully we'll be able to pick up in a couple months, everyone. Good night.